Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th. Years after passing mandatory health coverage in Massachusetts, the state is now looking to tackle rising costs. And as you have been listening to Republican presidential candidates, there's been a great deal of debate about whether or not the Massachusetts plan is similar to the federal plan. And there have been lots of statements made associating Mitt Romney with Massachusetts healthcare and implying that that is a bad plan. This hour of the program, we're going to have a really interesting conversation with two superb guests about the Massachusetts plan, how it compares to the federal plan, and also what's going on in the state of Massachusetts to tackle rising costs in healthcare. Early this year, Governor Deval Patrick filed a bill to control healthcare costs and urged the legislature to take it up right away. He says that changing the way we pay doctors has to be a key part of the state's plan to control health care costs. So we have two guests with us during the course of this hour. Alan Wheel is Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, and he is our first guest. Later we will speak with a professor of public health practice and director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. And he will be with us talking about the Massachusetts plan and the national plan because he has had a hand in fashioning both of those plans. Alan has been executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy since 2004. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with a mission of helping states achieve excellence in health policy and practice. They are located in Portland, Maine, and Washington, D.C., and they conduct policy analysis, convene meetings, and provide technical assistance to state officials in the executive and legislative branches. And we will be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Alan, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Tell me why you think it is that we are having so much spirited conversation still about not only the national health care plan, but also the Massachusetts plan, which has been in existence for some time now.
Well, I think it's easier to say why we're having the spirited conversation at the national level, because so many of the major components of the law have not yet been implemented. Everyone can project their own hopes or fears onto it and describe either how wonderful or terrible it's going to be without having any evidence to back up either argument. So it makes for it makes it really easy to talk about without having to refer much to reality.
Mm-hmm.
As for Massachusetts, because it is a leading state in the country in trying to address longstanding health problems, again, I think people are sort of lining up on either side to say this is a model we should use or it's the model we shouldn't. And it's an important reference point in the national discussion.
Mm-hmm. The Massachusetts plan has been, as you look at it, successful, problematic?
Well, it's been highly successful in its primary goal, which was to expand insurance coverage to pretty much everyone in the state. It's very hard to argue with the conclusion that the state has effectively eliminated or brought down to an extremely low level the number of people without health insurance, and that's exactly what it set out to do. I think you'd be hard-pressed to have any evidence to deny its success in that regard, which I think is now why the battleground has turned to the question of whether or not it's affordable.
The word that we always hear associated with this that seems to cause concern is the mandate part of the Massachusetts plan. Can you explain that, please?
Sure. Under the Massachusetts plan, individuals must demonstrate that they have had insurance coverage over the course of the year when they file their taxes. And what's important to understand is that that mandate is in place as a backstop against major expansions in coverage. So the public programs, Medicaid for low and moderate income people, subsidized coverage for working families, and a requirement on employers all come together to basically create opportunities for coverage. And then the mandate is the backstop that says, since we've made something available and affordable to you, you're obligated to buy it so that you're part of the risk pool in the state.
And does this, how do you deal with people of different income levels when you look at the mandate part of this?
Well, there are extensive subsidies based on people's income. So at the lower end of the range, you can get free coverage through the Medicaid program. Moderate income working families have a sliding scale price point that is run through the state that says, you know, based on your family income, this is how much it's going to cost you, and it's much less expensive than it would be on the open market. There is a process for families to be exempted from the mandate if they have some unusual circumstances, but basically, the deal is we've made the product affordable. Now your obligation is to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Have there been other states that have looked at Massachusetts and said, this is really working well, let's do the same?
Well, I think a lot of states are looking at Massachusetts and trying to find elements, but Massachusetts began with a relatively low share of the population uninsured, and it had a large federal waiver from Medicaid that enabled it to move some federal dollars around to pay for a lot of this program. So we haven't seen other states lining up. You know, the economy is not in such great shape. It's been hard for states, even if they would be interested, to do the same. Vermont is implementing a universal program that has some shared elements. But in terms of picking up the Massachusetts plan and saying, we're going to do it here, we don't have other states. And of course, right now, states are putting their energy into figuring out how to work with the new federal law. And so there's not a lot of state-level conversation until the federal law settles in.
And are there a number of similarities between Massachusetts and the federal law?
Absolutely. The structures are essentially identical, which doesn't mean that there aren't differences, and the differences are worth talking about. But the structures are identical. You expand free coverage to the lowest income folks so that you can say you're part of the insurance system. You make subsidized coverage available for people with moderate incomes because they really families making $40,000 cannot afford a $15,000 insurance plan on their own. And so you subsidize the coverage, and you put some modest requirements on businesses to participate, exempting the smallest. And then you say on the back end, we've now made it affordable, and so we need you to participate through the mandate. Those structural components are really identical between the two plans.
The New York Times had a piece, well, this has been written about extensively a few days ago, saying that those who led the 2006 effort to expand coverage readily acknowledged that they deferred the more daunting task of cost control for another day. Is that something that Massachusetts is dealing with now, and is cost control a serious problem?
Yes and yes. And yes. They
yes,
did
yes,
defer.
Yes.
On cost, because it's a really hard issue to tackle, and they decided that it would be easier to tackle when everyone was insured than when there are, in that state, hundreds of thousands, and in the country, tens of millions of people without insurance. If you do cost containment with a lot of people uninsured, you tend to actually increase the number of uninsured. They didn't want to do that. They had a cost containment commission created in their law, and it deliberated for a while, and now they are trying to take that issue on. And it's a huge issue throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is eating our lunch. Every person's prospective increase in salary from year to year is being eaten up by healthcare. Our ability to pay for education and transportation and other state and national priorities are all being consumed by the healthcare beast, and we absolutely, as a country, and Massachusetts is no exception, need to bring the cost of the system under control.
Well, how do we do that?
If it were only so easy. Well, I think the theme that you see being pursued in Massachusetts is one of trying to move away from paying what we think of the term in the healthcare system is fee for service. The more familiar term is just paying piece by piece. You go to the doctor gets paid. You go to the hospital gets paid. And what it turns out is that when you pay by piece, you get more pieces, because that's how your doctor and your hospital and all the other actors in the healthcare system survive. And the problem with being paid by piece is that it does nothing to create incentives for all of those people in the system to actually keep you healthy. And it also makes it very hard to do the pieces that would keep people healthy but we don't pay for, like help people manage their weight and quit smoking and take the medications they need to keep their chronic conditions under control. That kind of hands-on talking to patients, connecting them with community resources, those don't really work paying for them one at a time. And yet, in a system dominated by piece-by-piece payment, we underinvest in those things. So the idea is to move more to systems of care that get paid not just for the care they provide, but also for the broader objectives of keeping people healthy. Mm-hmm. This is not a new idea, and it's not an easy idea to put in place, but I'd say it's the framework around which most of the nation and the state's conversation in Massachusetts is built.
Alan, why is this such a contentious issue and has been for years and years and years? No sooner do we get a national bill than we get Supreme Court possible, you know, challenges that will go up to the Supreme Court looking at parts of that, this. Why? Why is it so hard to come up with something that might be a little easier and less expensive?
Well, it's so hard because health touches all of us, and Americans don't trust their government. And you put those two together, and the problem is we need some combined action. We need to work together to solve this problem. But the way the institutions we have to work together are government institutions, and the moment the government gets involved, people are not trusting of the direction that it's going to go. And because health is so personal, the fears that the government will play a destructive role as opposed to a productive role are very significant. I think that it's understandable why this is so challenging. It's also a seventh of our economy. And so when we say the system costs too much because no one's getting a pay raise because all their money's going into health care, remember that all of that money going to health care is paying someone's salary and profits and overhead and administration. And when you say we need to pay less of that, what you're saying is someone on the other end needs to get less of that.
Right.
And so between the economics and the personal nature of this, this is a very hard area to work in.
And my understanding about Massachusetts is that doctors would be paid differently. Patients would get sort of a lump sum for health care, and doctors would have to manage that, and many of them in Massachusetts are not keen on that idea?
Well, I think the big question as you move away from paying for piecework is who gets the bundle of money and makes the allocation decisions. And again, this ties back to your last question about why this is so hard. You don't want your doctor to have gotten a fixed cash amount, and then every time you go see them, they're sitting there thinking, I'm not making any money on this, and I've got better things to do, and therefore they're discouraged from meeting your needs. What you really want is that money to go to a system of care that includes not just your doctor, but potentially also the hospitals and the specialists and your primary care doctor and some social workers and nurses and a broader system that can, again, look at you and say, wow, if we if we communicate with you more effectively, if we make email communication available to you so that when you have a problem, you can talk to someone right away and get a response, you're going to stay healthier, and it's going to put a much smaller burden on the healthcare system. And we're not going to worry about who's paying for that because we've already been paid to help take care of you. Now, the problem is you need a trusting organization to take care of that, because there are a lot of folks out there who look at all the money in the healthcare system and say, I want a piece of it without returning anyone good health. So you need a trusted organization. You need methods of accountability. This is not about giving your doctor a cash payment. It's really about trying to develop systems of care that have a continuum that can meet your needs. But those systems don't exist in equal form around the country.
We welcome phone calls for Andrew. Andrew Weil is our guest the first half hour of the show. Alan has been executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy since 2004. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with a mission of helping states achieve excellence in health policy and practice. He is the editor of two books, Welfare Reform, The Next Act, and Federalism and Health Policy. He was appointed a member of President Clinton's Advisory Commission on Consumer Protection and Quality in the Healthcare Industry, which drafted the Patient's Bill of Rights, a member of the Institute of Medicine's Board on Healthcare Services, the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and the Commonwealth Fund Commission on a High-Performing Health System. And we are welcoming phone calls for him. If you'd like to speak with Alan Weil about this, later we'll be speaking with a gentleman who's professor of public health practice and director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. He helped fashion both the Massachusetts plan and the federal plan. Here is our phone number. Why is this still a contentious issue? Do you see similarities between the Massachusetts plan and the federal plan? Here is our phone number. Should Mitt Romney be proud of what happened in Massachusetts, or does he need to walk away from it? And why are we still talking about this years and years and years and years after we realized we had a major problem? 800-486-8655 is our number. Lines are open for you right now, and we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Chrissy Pease is our on-air producer. She'll be answering calls, and we'll get with you on the air momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, Anita Hill, will be with us. It was 20 years ago this month that the hearings took place, Clarence Thomas hearings, in which she played such a riveting role. She has a new book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. Anita Hill, our number two. 800-486-8655 is our number for your phone calls for Alan Weil. And we start with John in Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Good morning. I just tuned in, so I'm not up to speed on the earlier part of the show, but I'm very interested in this subject, and your guest seems to be very, very qualified to talk on it. I have no problem with what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. I have no problem with what the governor of Minnesota wants to do in Minnesota. I am very interested in what Wisconsin does, however. I believe that these broad health issues of cost and access to care ought to be dealt with on a state level. I am very opposed to federal involvement. And I think that the closer we get the decision-making and the controls to the local level, where people that know our health care systems, know our providers, and know our communities can have some input. And I'll take my comments off the air, but I very much oppose any federal involvement, and I'm very pleased that Mitt Romney is assuring us that he has no plans of enforcing anything that he did in Massachusetts on the country.
Okay.
I'm very opposed to what Obama did, what is commonly known as Obamacare, which is a complete disaster, and I think would be very bad for America.
Alan.
Well, I work with states every day, and I am very respectful of the commitment and the desire to solve these problems at the state level. but we have had a very long history of expecting states to solve these problems on their own, and they've been unable to do so. And the primary reason they've been unable to do so is that health care costs are high, health insurance costs are high, and states simply do not have the financial resources to expand coverage to those who need it. And, of course, the federal budget is under tremendous pressure as well. I'm not suggesting somehow that this can be done for free, but one of the advantages that then-Governor Romney had was a large amount of federal money to pay for his program. And so I don't think we should ever imagine that this can be done for free, whether it's at the state or national level. And I also, one of the big challenges that states face is that large employers are regulated only by the federal government. The Medicare program dominates how the healthcare system views payment. Veterans programs, Indian Health Services, federal employees, when you add it all up, the federal government's role in the healthcare system is very large, and we can't, states really can't just work around that. They have to work with it. So I am very supportive of trying to build state-level efforts to address the problems in the healthcare system. That's what I do every single day. But I also think we have to be aware that it is just not really possible for states to solve this problem on their own, and so there's going to be a federal role. And the question then becomes, what is the role and how prescriptive is it? And I'm comfortable and would be comfortable in a world where the federal role was more setting goals and states were more about figuring out how to do it within those goals. But we haven't made a lot of progress on these issues state by state. And so I think just saying, I want the state to solve it, it means that the states won't solve it.
Thanks, John, for the call. William in Rhinelander, hi.
Good morning. Your guest, I wonder if he's familiar with this. I read it in the New York Times almost a year ago when the whole debate was going on in the USA. The Swiss system was written up in a brief article in the Sunday New York Times, and basically they had invited the medical profession, the insurance companies, I'm not quite sure, but I think citizen representation, and maybe some government, not federal government, but probably cantonal government representative. That last point I'm not familiar with. And they came up with consensus. The insurance companies could make only so much percent profit, the medical profession only so much profit, and so on. And they sat down, and they waited, and everybody went home. And I believe, if I'm right, this is the lowest cost insurance in the developed countries in the whole world.
Alan?
Well, the European systems in general do operate from some very defined levels of spending at the national and sometimes the state or provincial or cantonal level. We don't have a political system in this country that lends itself to that kind of sitting down and agreeing. We also don't have the commitment to universal coverage that was the underpinning of the conversation that occurred in Switzerland and in all of the other continental European countries, which says, here's the amount we have, and we're going to divide it up, but we're not going to leave anyone out. So we're missing some of the structures as a nation that were, and some of the political consensus as a nation that made it possible to achieve those ends in not just Switzerland, but in different ways in other European countries. And that sets us apart from the rest of the world, and it means we need to find a solution that does fit our institutions and our politics and our heterogeneity as a nation. So it's clear that this can be done, and we can serve everyone with very high quality care at a lower cost. But our political system struggles to find the kind of consensus that the caller described.
One more phone call for you. Same topic. We'll just switch guests. Janice in La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen and your guests. Thank you so much for this great program. Just a couple points. Number one, I still don't understand why we don't emphasize health and staying healthy. I'm so tired of it's all the numbers and how much it's going to cost. I mean, I have major medical. I don't even want to go over to the hospital if I obviously don't have to. If you walk through the door, it's a couple hundred dollars, and you don't even know what happened, you know. So, I mean, it's like, no, we need to encourage people for health and stay healthy. And this, I really hate this system. And Obamacare, I'm a Catholic, and I am not going to pay for abortions or contraceptives. I mean, I just won't. I just assume go to jail for this. Thank you.
Well, I won't try to address the second issue, which is a matter of personal conscience. But the first issue, I couldn't agree more. We have a sick care-oriented healthcare system. And one of the goals we need is not just to orient people toward keeping themselves healthy, which I think is something we could all agree, but orient the healthcare system, the doctors and the nurses and the hospitals, also toward keeping us healthy. And I think there are aspects of the federal law that are trying to do that. I'm not sure they're going to do it perfectly well, but the payment issues that we started with and that I will now end with are tied to, again, the notion of saying to the doctor, we actually care a lot more about whether you keep your patients healthy than about how many times they come into your office. And right now, we only pay you when they come into your office. And if you're a surgeon, we only pay you if you cut them open. And instead, we want you to find out what your patients really need, and we want you to connect them to resources that maybe aren't physicians that will help keep them healthy, or divert them to alternative kinds of care that are less intrusive, like therapies as opposed to surgery for back pain. And you as a whole system, a healthcare system, should reorient yourself toward helping people do what your caller wants to do, which is to stay healthy and stay out of the healthcare system. That, after all, is what most people want. But the healthcare system only gets paid when you come in. So I think I couldn't agree with the caller more. The entire system of care that we have is oriented in a direction that in many respects is counter to what most of us want to do on a day-to-day basis. It's great at curing us when we have an acute illness, but other than that, it doesn't align with what we want to do in our lives. And unfortunately, reorienting a large, complex system is not a simple task, but I think it's the one that faces the country.
Ellen, thank you so much for all of your knowledge and for being with us. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Ellen Weil, our guest, the first half of this discussion, Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. We continue our conversation. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We have as our guest Professor John McDonough, a professor of public health practice at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of the Center for Public Health Leadership. He's an interesting guy to talk to because he has this unique perspective. He was a top advisor on the National Healthcare Overhaul Plan, and he also played a key role in advancing and implementing the Massachusetts law. He is the author of Inside National Health Reform, which details the effort that led to the national overhaul, including his work on the issue with Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. His articles have appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, Health Affairs, and his articles have appeared in many journals. He's written three books, and we're delighted to have Professor McDonough with us right now. Professor McDonough, hello. Thanks very much for joining us.
Welcome. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're the guy. You're the go-to guy on the whole subject, aren't you?
There's a lot of us.
Yeah, I guess, except that you have this unique perspective of being involved in implementing Massachusetts and also the national plan. So we keep hearing, you know, Romney Care and Obamacare, and the two of them are terrible, and we've been trying to understand the similarities and the differences. First of all, your thoughts about the Massachusetts plan. Is it a whole lot better than it used to be, or are there still problems with it?
Well, the law did what it was intended to do, which is to engineer a dramatic drop in the number of Massachusetts residents who don't have health insurance and to provide some real security in terms of cost sharing and premiums for folks who did have health insurance, but it was pretty unaffordable for them. So we've gotten the rate of uninsurance in Massachusetts from around 8% to down below 2%, and there are almost no uninsured children in Massachusetts anymore. So the law did that. Some people criticize it for not controlling costs. It was not designed to control cost. However, the passage of the law has triggered a really robust and quite extensive cost control process here in Massachusetts, which is still going on. And Massachusetts is probably having one of the most extensive efforts anywhere in any state right now you're going to find to really try to figure out how to get costs under control. And obviously that work's not done. No one in the country has really figured out a politically saleable way to dramatically control and reduce the rate of costs, but we're certainly giving it a good try.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that all of the Republican candidates, including the Republican candidate who implemented this, are walking away from Massachusetts?
Well, Mitt Romney's not walking away from Massachusetts, as I hear him saying. In fact, I think he actually does an okay job defending it. What he says is that he's not proposing that this is a solution for the whole nation. And that's a change in the message he was giving out in 2006, 7, and 8, but that's where he is right now. The thing about comparing Massachusetts reform and the federal health reform law, some people call it Obamacare, I call it the Affordable Care Act, but the thing to understand is that the National Health Reform Law is a big, broad set of titles and provisions dealing with the entire healthcare system. The first title of the 10 titles of the law deals with changing private health insurance in all 50 states across the country. Massachusetts deeply reflects what's in that one title of the law. Title one of the federal law really is drawn from what we did in Massachusetts, and that includes about really four major planks. One is serious, deep, systemic reform of health insurance, particularly individual health insurance, through something known as guaranteed issue, where insurance companies can't refuse to write you coverage anymore because you had a cancer episode or went to see a shrink some years ago. So that's number one. Number two is the individual responsibility requirement that some people refer to as a mandate. Number three is subsidies to make the purchase of health insurance affordable for lower-income and moderate-income families. And four is creating this mechanism known as a health insurance exchange to try to make the process of buying health insurance as easy and consumer-friendly for consumers as, say, buying a book on Amazon is.
Mm-hmm.
And so those four are the four cornerstones of Massachusetts health reform, and they are the essential architecture of Title I of the federal law. The other nine titles have very little to do with what was done in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. But the governor, the former governor Romney, has said that his first act as president would be to issue waivers to every single state, allowing them to opt out of requirements of the federal health care plan. What is he targeting here? What's he saying?
Oh, he is suggesting, but he's not really giving a lot of detail in connection with it, that his first dramatic act will be to use authority in the federal law to essentially allow states to escape any obligation under the law. And I don't know who's advising him, but that is a significant misreading of the law. There is a provision in the law that allows states to get waivers to do something dramatically different if they want to, but states have no ability to get one of those waivers, and the federal government has no legal authority to grant a waiver until 2017 at the earliest. So the notion that he's going to come in and do this on January 21st, 2013, he doesn't have the legal authority to do this.
Why is it so darn difficult to come up with a much easier plan and to not have to figure out what the complexities are of all of these? It just seems so difficult, and this conversation has been so difficult.
You're absolutely right. And there are easier, simpler plans. There are a lot of them. And the truth is that none of them can garner sufficient support. I mean, the most popular one, which is very unpopular with a lot of people, is taking a version of, say, Medicare and making it available to everybody, Medicare for all, sometimes also, you know, referred to as the Canadian single-payer type system. And there are a lot of people who feel very passionately in favor of that, including a fair number of people in the Congress, and it has nowhere close to majority support in the House or the U.S. Senate. We tried to do a nose count of how many senators we thought would vote for an effort Bernie Sanders from Vermont was making to put a single-payer proposal on the floor. We could never get out of single digits. And so the challenge was we could go down in flames and see nothing happen, or try to figure out how to make something happen that could actually get through the process. And, mm-hmm. and that's always the challenge in terms of being in a legislature.
Tell me about the work that you did with a senator who had made it his life's work to do something about this issue, Senator Edward Kennedy.
Well, I had served in the Massachusetts legislature for 13 years and deeply involved in health insurance. I ran the state consumer advocacy organization that was called Healthcare for All during the Massachusetts health reform process, and so it worked very closely with Senator Kennedy over many years on many health issues. And so in 2008, when it looked like there would be another effort to try to do national health reform, he asked me if I would come down and work on his staff, which was the Senate Help Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. So I was there from mid-2008 into early 2010 as a staffer trying to help in constructing what became the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm. And who are the parties, who are the organizations that seem to be reluctant to want to change this garbled system that we have right now? It's hard to understand why we wouldn't want to implement something in the country that would give insurance to people, that you could make sure that you didn't have to worry about an operation that you had making you unable to get insurance. Not that that's not changing here, but the resistance to dealing with the whole system has been huge. On the part of whom? Who doesn't want it?
Well, when we started this process in 2008, going almost halfway through 2009, we were in what I call the era of health reform good feeling. And every major party, the business community, insurers,
right.
hospitals, physicians,
mm-hmm.
consumers, labor, business, everybody was at the table saying, yeah, we got to do something. Failure is not an option. The worst thing we can do is to do nothing. And there was a lot of agreement. We've got to expand coverage, and we've got to improve the system to get more value for the enormous sums of money America invests in healthcare relative to any other country. And that is a very common phenomenon where at the start everybody agrees, or most people agree. But then when you start putting real proposals on the table that actually say, okay, we're going to do it this way as opposed to that way, and by the way, here's how we're going to pay for it, then lots of people who quite honestly feel they're doing pretty darn well under the existing system start to throw up a lot of resistance. So, you know, over the course of the second half of 2009 into 2010, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce invested over about $110 million in advertising against the law as the voice of small business. And it only came out in 2010 that of that $110 million, about $86 million of it was directly given to them by the health insurance industry.
Oh, my.
So they never disclosed that. And so people saw all these ads and said, wow, this must be really bad for small business. But the Chamber of Commerce was fronting for the health insurance industry. But, you know, the Chamber of Commerce didn't like it either because they don't like the idea of telling any employer what they might do around providing better coverage for their workers. And so so there's a lot of that. You know, people feel very, very passionately about health care. And people are also very easily frightened and confused. So, for example, even today, 20 months after the passage of the law, there's still maybe about a quarter of Americans who actually believe that the Affordable Care Act contains what are known as death panels, where there will be federal bureaucrats who will sit at a table and decide, yes, this Medicare enrollee can continue to live, and this one we're going to withdraw treatment and they're going to die. And there's nothing in the law like that, but there are folks who really do honestly believe that because that's what they're being told by sources they trust. There are lots of people who believe that beginning in 2014, everybody's going to have to drop their employer coverage and go into one of these new exchanges, and the exchanges are there for people who can't get employer coverage or can't get it from another source. And so there's a lot of misinformation, and some of it is just people who are confused, and some of it, quite honestly, there are still lots and lots of people who view it in their interest to see this law not get implemented and to see it fail.
Doesn't this all drive you crazy sometimes?
This is the way our system works. God love it, you know, for the first time, in about 100 years since we've been trying to do this. We're on the other side of passing serious comprehensive reform. And if you look across the spectrum of the U.S. healthcare system, I'm talking about physicians, hospitals, nursing home industry, the insurance industry, states, people working on prevention, people trying to improve the healthcare workforce, there are lots and lots of problems, but there's more energy and experimentation and vibrancy going on right now in America to try to figure out how to not create the magic perfect system, but to do so much better than where we are right now. We have never seen this level of energy and commitment and drive to try to improve healthcare than we're seeing right now. This is really important, momentous time in terms of really trying to get ourselves to a better place as a society in relation to our healthcare system.
Professor John McDonough is with us this part of the show, professor of public health practice, director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Health. He's quite a guy because he was a top advisor on the National Healthcare Overall Plan and also on the Massachusetts law. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, Anita Hill, will be joining us. It's been 20 years since those hearings that we remember, if we were alive during those years. She's the author of a new book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. She is now a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. And the book doesn't really look at Clarence Thomas. It's a book on the subprime mortgage crisis, actually, which she details pretty thoroughly, and what home means to us, and particularly what home how difficult it's been because of gender and race issues to establish a sense of home. So she will be with us. I will ask her about Clarence Thomas, though, too, even though we have a lot to talk about with the subprime mortgage crisis. That's our number two. To your phone calls again, and we go to Aaron in Harvard, Illinois. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Aaron, how are you?
All right, so good. I deal with health benefits in terms of the administrative aspects for a living. So I understand that you've got the administrative cost, which is at an all-time low. Technology has given us the ability to administrate health insurance cheaper than we ever have been. You've got funding, and so we can, with technology, we can model better than anything that anyone has ever been able to do in history before now. But at the end of the day, when I walk into the doctor, if that cost is like $200, nobody's ever asking, it doesn't seem, why is it so expensive? And I hear the rhetoric from people saying, you know, it's the insurance the doctors are paying. And so I guess the question I have is, what percentage of the revenue stream of any healthcare provider is actually paid out in insurance? What percentage of the pharmaceutical drug that I'm paying for is paid out insurance to protect them? I mean, is tort reform really an issue?
Boy, there's so much in there. Thank you for that question. It's a little challenging. It varies a lot, and yes, it's true. We're doing, I think, better in some respects in terms of modernizing the administrative structure of health insurance. And in fact, there are significant provisions in the Affordable Care Act which are designed to bring administrative efficiency to the system at a level that we haven't seen before. And so I think there are opportunities there, and there are opportunities for significant savings that I believe we'll see that will exceed the projections by the Congressional Budget Office. And still, we have the most expensive administrative structure of any system in any advanced nation on the planet. And we could do it much simpler, and that would be one way to save a lot of money. But there are a lot of people who make their living from that structure. In terms of providers and how much they get from insurance, it really varies an awful lot. Most of the provider income comes from insurance, but it varies a lot in terms of how much get it from Medicare, Medicaid, other public sources versus private insurance. And They all have litanies of problems with private insurers and with public insurers as well. So it's really a mixed bag. In terms of medical malpractice, and how much of an issue is that? I think, you know, one lesson is to look at Texas. Texas did probably the most aggressive kind of tort and medical liability reform that we've seen in any state by doing really severe California-style limits on pain and suffering in lawsuits. And Texas still has health insurance premiums that are rising at a very fast rate. And so while I think that the tort reform was helpful to physicians in terms of their medical malpractice premiums, it is hard to look at Texas and see that then spilled over and had a really positive effect in terms of health insurance premiums for regular Texans. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence on that.
Thank you, Aaron. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. I find it very frustrating. It seems like this country is on the verge of being ungovernable because so many people seem to be deluded. About half an hour ago, I was listening to somebody passionately ranting about what a disaster Obamacare has been for this country. And how could he possibly know that, since the really meat and potatoes part of that program has yet to take effect until like 2014? I mean, are people just delusional? Do they lack any kind of critical thinking ability? What's going on?
I think that there was a mixture in this process where there are some folks who had issues and concerns relative to health care, and there were some people for whom this issue just became significantly politicized and polarized around people's political views. And it's probably exemplified in late July 2009 when Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina had a conference call with a conservative activist from around the country. And what he said, and it was recorded and he hasn't denied it because people have his voice, is he said to these folks, he said, listen, if we can stop health reform, if we can stop it, it will be President Obama's Waterloo. And he did use that word in particular, his Waterloo, and we will bring down his presidency. And so there are folks who are deeply passionately concerned about health care and don't agree with this direction, and there are other folks for whom I really do think this is a politically charged issue, and that is what makes it so significantly electrified and so difficult to deal with.
One of the things that people should be very proud of in Massachusetts, and I wonder what the national number is on this, it seems to me as though almost everybody would agree, I would think, that it's sinful to have had the large, large percentage of people who are uninsured in this country. And I understand that Massachusetts, the number is extremely low right now. That's something to cheer about, isn't it?
Well, we think so. We're actually pretty proud of it. It's under, you know, so the national level is around 17% of Americans don't have health insurance. By the way, in Texas, more than a third of adults don't have any health insurance at all, more than a third. And in Massachusetts, the total rate of uninsurance is under 2%. So, yeah, we're proud, and I think what we've done is we've shown it is possible to lick this problem. It's not easy, and it's controversial. And people get upset, and there are, you know, always people who are unhappy with this aspect or that aspect. But the big picture is that we've moved so far ahead, we don't even have a peer state at this point.
We go to Karen next in, oh, we're almost out of time, darn. Rolling Stone, Minnesota, hi.
Oh, I'll just mention one of the points then. What a wonderful program, thank you. My family doctor, who is in Wisconsin, we continue to go back to him because he's such a fine doctor, was telling me, I asked him a question when the Affordable Health Care Act was first being discussed, and he said that another one of the problems with high costs was that he believed, and he had data also to back this up, that many, many, many fewer medical students were choosing family practice instead of being a specialist. They were choosing to be a specialist. The costs of people going to specialists, some of them who have no family care physicians as the first line of defense, is so high, so much higher, and that I'd appreciate your guest's comment on that.
All right.
I think it's widely agreed by people who study the healthcare system that the imbalance between primary care, family practice docs versus specialists is, in fact, one of the drivers that makes our system so much more expensive. Most other systems, however they do it, whether they use more market or more government, have a much higher proportion of primary care docs relative to specialists. And those systems seem to do a better job in terms of providing better value and not having such an excessive number of unnecessary procedures. So there's something there, and there are a lot of people who are working on it, and there are a bunch of provisions in the Affordable Care Act that are directly aimed at trying to redress that imbalance. One of the best ones is there's this wonderful program called the National Health Service Corps, where a medical student comes out of medical school, comes out of their internship, and spends a couple of years working in an underserved health area anywhere across the span of the United States and gets some significant federal help in paying off their medical debt. Because of the Affordable Care Act, the number of physicians in this program has more than tripled from around 3,000 to now over 10,000.
Oh, my. Well, you were a great guest. Thank you so much.
Can I just plug my book one second?
Yeah, very quickly. Go ahead.
I have a book called Inside National Health Reform, which is a user-friendly guide and explanation of the Affordable Care Act, where it came from, what's
actually
in it, why it is the way it is.
Let's get it. Let's do an hour down the road, please.
You betcha.
Thank you. Professor John McDonough, and we will do an hour with him down the road. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this superb hour. Great guests. Chrissy Pease for on-air production in Milwaukee. Anita Hill is coming up soon.